It's a good book style, though. These heaters that I didn't really hot me, they're off. Well, I'm very pleased to introduce Chris Wood, who's a student at the centre and who's doing a DPhil in the theology faculty. Chris has a degrees in theology from Birmingham and where else was?
MST here,
and he's been working on theology and psychology, particularly with regard to meditation and systems of yoga, meditation and devotion. And part of his work has been empirical and part of it has been conceptual, and so he's going to tell us about some of that work today. And the title of his paper is The Teleology of Meditation. So, Chris, over to you.
Thank you for coming. I haven't done this before, so it'll probably be terrible. If you need a good nap, please go ahead. I thought that I would just begin by basically reading excerpts of what I've written, which might be the easiest sort of thing. So, initially, the word teleology is not terribly common, right? It's actually, I remember when I was quite young, I remember reading a book on philosophy which erroneously put the taxonomy of meditation forward, that it was ontology, epistemology, metaphysics, and not ethics, but teleology. So I did my undergrad degree in philosophy thinking, oh, where's all the teleology going? It is a very interesting concept, but anyway. The word teleology, teleologia in Latin, comes from the Greek word telos, meaning purpose or end, and logos, meaning the word of God, or the principle of divine reason or creative order, or more simply, the study of something. The standard philosophical definition is that something is understood teleologically if its existence or action is seen as being oriented towards a purpose. Teleology is thus the study or theory of purposeness within the universe, with the implication that certain phenomena are best understood not in terms of previous causes, but rather in terms of ends, purposes, intentions, or aims. From Aristotle comes the traditional view that teleology involves the notion of a final cause, alongside the material, formal, and efficient causes, where the purpose is conceived of as the cause of that which leads to such an end state. Teleology has two sub-meanings, nomological, which refers to the existence of design in the universe, and eutaxiological, which refers to the existence of purpose. The term teleology is perhaps best known in its form as a Christian argument for the existence of God, centering around notions of apparent design within the universe. Other than these Christian and Aristotelian musings, teleology is itself a concept that has been paid scant attention by either Western philosophers or academics. Francis Bacon's dismissal of it as epistemologically sterile, and he said, inquiry into final causes is sterile, and like a virgin consecrated to God, produces nothing. It was one of the opening chords of the Enlightenment embrace in order to distance itself from the stranglehold ancient Aristotelian dogmas held over both science and philosophy. And the Western scientific tradition that followed in Bacon's intellectual wake gradually concluded that teleology was of no practical or even theoretical use. Although it may be tempting to attempt to partially trace the collapse of concepts of overarching meaning that we find in our present epoch to some form of origin in this statement of Bacon's. In fact, he took great care to distinctly separate both philosophy and science from religion, and his statement is much more simply a reflection of his interest in the inductive method and the natural sciences. And what was perceived as a necessity of removing such epistemological questions from the sphere of psychological intrigues, such as intentions. It was Hume's critique of teleology in Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion that was to have the most notable effect on conceptions of teleology in its attempts to annihilate any arguments for the existence of God that may rest on ideas of an ordered and thus designed universe. Otherwise, amidst modern Western philosophers, it is only Immanuel Kant who pays any particular attention to teleology and receives such little interest in return. The swift death of teleological arguments in the natural sciences and their slow 18th and 19th century death in the biological sphere, despite Goethe's profuse protests, coupled with the continued drift of Western philosophy into increasingly pragmatic and analytic territory, has all led to the present state of disinterest in this particular term. I hope for the purpose of this study it will become evident to the reader that it is in fact a concept that has significant relevance to many people, regardless of our ideological persuasion, in the sense of it simply bearing on the word purpose. The Oxford Dictionary of English defines teleology as the explanation of phenomena by the purpose they serve, rather than postulated causes, which is very curious in two senses. Firstly, it is a definition quite illogically removed from Aristotle's understanding of teleology as causal. Secondly, it would appear to aptly indicate contemporary disinterest in teleology in the sense that it represents it as somehow referring to states of acausality. Since it is the case that people's behaviour is clearly motivated and caused by direct reflection on the reference to purpose of conceptions, one might perhaps forgive the brevity of this particular definition. The definition of purpose given in the same dictionary, the reason for which something is done or created, or for which something exists, a person's sense of resolve or determination to have as one's intention or objective, highlights the fact that purposes are causal and existential, and brings our attention to the potential importance of teleology as an aid in understanding psychological, philosophical, and religious phenomena. The crux of this importance lies in the position teleology occupies as that part of an individual's psyche that prompts into praxis, even if indeed that praxis means the solitude of uninterrupted thought. In abstract theoretical discourse, it is that part of overarching theories that promotes some specific praxis, even if it is the no-thought of Zazen. In this sense, teleology is something that transcends the philosophical boundaries of its normal theological context and becomes applicable to a wide range of experiences. I was just going to read a little bit about methodology, because it's quite relevant. This is a quote from Nicholas Lash. Thus, in due time, science came to conquer every realm and territory of the world, and could then gaze with condescension upon the remnants of philosophy, now banished either to the barren uplands of freewheeling speculation, unconstrained by fact, this is what they do in France and Germany, or to the dark caves in which academics quarrel pathetically over scraps of language, this is how they live in Oxford. While psychology, not most humanistic of self-professed sciences, has demonstrated an increasing interest over the last 2 to 3 decades into inquiry about what psychologists often term spirituality, correspondingly there has been little reciprocal interest displayed towards the theoretical dimensions of religion and theism in particular. The starting point for the vast majority of psychological research concerning the praxis of Eastern religious traditions in fact normally begins with the overt or implicit assertion that religion is a worrying phenomenon that is best left behind, thereby enabling the business of the practical application of techniques of meditation and yoga to the woes of modern mental existence to be conducted with an enhanced degree of simplicity, clarity, and pragmatism. Considering the systematic neglect of theoretical issues that are connected within the traditions themselves to the praxis that are being increasingly investigated by contemporary psychological researchers, and the high degree of suspicion with which theological claims in particular are held, it would perhaps be more convenient for any study attempting to explore such issues connected with psychology to adopt a general methodology which would be more properly situated within the area of religious studies and theology. However, what I hope to outline here is that whilst methodologies more closely associated with religious studies do offer invaluable aid in assessing the relationship between the practices of Eastern religions and the psychological investigation, for the purposes of this study, it will be better to rely upon the more traditional methodologies and epistemologies related to the academic study of theology, especially that type of theology that concerns itself with existential issues. To this end, this initial section will consider some of the underlying issues connected with methodologies of the research and religious studies in theology, particularly claims concerning the desirability of utilizing phenomenological and dialogical methods of inquiry, which will be followed by a closer look are two of the most influential proponents of perspectives on religious experience, Otto and Schleiermacher. The basic proposal I wish to make is that some type of phenomenological-based approach is best suited to an inquiry that will take as much of its focus, meditative traditions that are concerned with the individual, specifically internal and often incommunicable experience of what is considered to be the sacred or holy. I hope that it will be shown throughout the study that the type of pragmatic approach which can be adopted by phenomenological methodologies particularly suited to questions of the practical application of meditation to psychological concerns. The initial question that may be raised is why one should not choose to investigate religious praxis and even religions themselves, purely within the paradigms of psychology. Does all, or even some, of the attendant theoretical baggage really need to be included? Doesn't it just obscure attempts at pragmatic applications of such praxis to mental health issues? Since this is one of the main questions that this thesis concerns itself with, I shall hope for a brief answer, that a brief answer will suffice for now. That religions are certain kinds of value-laden narrative and action that can be distinguished from other kinds of cultural forms, but which are only given life within specific cultures. I would certainly agree that religious studies, and particularly the discipline of theology, needs to have greater discourse with other areas within the academy, that they both have to engage with postmodern and meta-theoretical issues as they are developing within the humanities in general, or is becoming increasingly intellectually isolating. As Nicholas Lash observes, too much theology still spins in voids of piety or disembodied biblical interpretation. There is certainly much to be said for an increase of systematic critical awareness of the types of underlying theoretical structures that govern both religious studies and theology. In particular, a great deal of what I hope to accomplish by asking questions about the assumptions of psychological approaches to the investigation of Eastern forms of religious praxis is precisely to add some degree of contextualization to such research endeavors by considering how, in particular, hitherto ignored issues of soteriology, eschatology, and teleology may affect such investigations, and specifically, the practical implementation of their results. The dialogical method utilizes the fact that researcher and research are in a unified dialogue, but it would appear that in order to honestly enter into such a relationship, there must be at least some degree of openness and trust on behalf of the researcher, some degree of suspension of judgment that may have posited the research subjects in the worst scenarios as a priori hopelessly self-deluded. This also means suspending to some extent judgment as to whether a purely historical, social, temporal inquiry is actually going to be sufficient to comprehend what is precisely held to be, both in theoretical and practical exposition, something that transcends our immediate sensory and rational experiences of time and space. The researcher may not have any inclination or even remote belief in the possibility of entirely abandoning what the researched may view as a chronic cramp of empirical and rational consciousness to the actual extent of experiencing something transtemporal for themselves. But at the very least, an initial, and at least partial sustained openness to the possibility of such experiences occurring would seem to be a foundational element of any discussion about the soteriological and eschatological dimensions of what is being researched. If this sort of bracketing is not employed, then it is quite possible that having set out to explore the universe of our dialogical thermometer, we discover that the sole component of the cosmos is temperature, or just heated debate. To uphold the ultimately indeterminate nature of research, within this context at least, is to initially assume the necessary relevance of a relativistic position, or the view from everywhere. Since Nietzsche, the world of scholarship has arguably crept into a new type of universalism and essentialism in the form of a continued insistence on the impossibility of overarching narratives and the assumption that there is no experience and ultimately no dialogue that could ever bring any form of closure. Without some kind of intellectual suspension, all non-empirically verifiable ontology slips from our inquiring grasp, and along with it, any sense of the potential connections between the internal psychological states and transformations which your practitioners claim to be experiencing, and the ultimate ontological reality that is often the very telos of those attempts at personal transformation. This is not in any sense an attempt to initially claim that there is an actual relationship between some transcendent reality and the psychological transformations of practitioners attempting soteriological release, other than the obvious teleological ones, but simply an attempt not to initiate this research by invalidating the possible psychological relationships between the practice of various systems of meditation and their stated eschatological and soteriological goals. This is not an attempt to claw back Eastern forms of praxis into their soteriological and eschatological boxes from some allegedly detached position, but rather in the spirit of the Indian Vada tradition, an attempt at classification of difference that attempts to understand how and to what extent psychological research has deftly removed praxis from their original soteriological, eschatological, and teleological dimensions. This will involve closely studying how received narratives within individual religious traditions delineate how meditation is to be practiced, and what types of psychological transformations are to be expected. In an attempt to understand how the facts of meditative techniques are situated within wider teleological narratives, provided both by the traditions themselves and, increasingly, by the contemporary psychological interpreters. Considering that scientific acumen is displayed not in prose, but in predictive ability, the great weakness of theological discourses when compared to such an apparently stringent methodology is that the considerable part of what theology seeks to assess by considering eschatological and soteriological claims is very usually, at least in the more traditional religions, something that would either require empirical verification after the demise of the physical being, or that the investigators themselves engage in some form of attempt at religious praxis, with the aim of experiencing here and now the reality of what is claimed by various traditions. Certainly a complete disregard for historical and social context is not desirable, but it is that very freedom to theoretically delve beyond the empirical matrices of history and society that arguably differentiates the study of theology from all other disciplines within the intellectual sphere. As Karl Barth wrote in Summa Theologia, the theology department is like an alarm bell ringing within the academy, warning us that perhaps not all is as it appears to be. In order for those alarm bells not to be too distant, obscure, or irritating, much work surely does need to be done in relating theology to other disciplines, such as sociology or anthropology, utilizing meta-theory. But it is perhaps not the only ground where these approaches can meet, because the ultimate closure of death finds us all, and then there is the entirely rational possibility that there just might be something more than our armor crashing around our ankles and the darkness cloaking our eyes forever. So this is a bit more about the psychology then. Alongside the claim that Western theologians have prioritized subjective individual accounts of religious experience, rather than acknowledge the often socially based, personally transformative nature of such praxis, which has led to a paucity of understanding of Eastern forms of meditative practice. In this short section, I would like to briefly outline a parallel argument. So this is kind of just an abstraction of it. That psychological experimentation has almost entirely disregarded the philosophical and theological context within which such praxis are developed, but that such experimentation would be enhanced by such reflection, especially by consideration of the theological dimensions of meditative praxis. Whilst there have been numerous clinical trials, I mean, it's actually difficult to say, I'm yet to put my number on it, but I think it's certainly more than 1,000, although some people claim it's like 25 or something, but I think that's the sort of the ones that are considered to be very sort of stringently scientifically relevant. Whilst there have been numerous clinical studies conducted that have attempted to assess whether various forms of Eastern meditative practice are of any actual benefit to human psychology, that have been undoubtedly of great importance in initializing what may potentially be a beneficial relationship between the practical dimensions of Eastern thought in the myriad mental woes of contemporary life, it is the contention of this study that there are several crucial factors that have not been taken into consideration by the clinical research so far. This claim specifically relates to the entirely unsystematic manner in which there is an apparently arbitrary application of a particular type of meditational practice to specific psychological conditions, with virtually no consideration given to the theoretical context of such practices, the soteriological and eschatological purposes within which such practices have arisen and developed. When one considers the diverse range of moral, soteriological, and eschatological perspectives that relate directly to meditative practice, one may claim that such perspectives have one element in common, which is that they are all to some degree purposive. In this sense, the word teleological would appear to be the most appropriate in attempting to convey the essential element of purpose that underlies the concepts of soteriology, eschatology, and morality, especially as they relate to the processes of realization within the particular traditions. To not consider the purposes of the context within which such practices exist is to render clinical investigations prone to a late colonial and orientalist attitude, whereby the isolation and appropriation of particular aspects of Eastern thought or praxis is conducted in a manner that legitimates their systematic decontextualization. In this sense, teleology is not an abstract philosophical concoction, but rather the bare bones of a philosophical or religious system that is prima facie attempting to present purpose or purposes that directly propel individuals into some sort of praxis. This teleological approach itself thus denotes, within different traditions, an entire psychological spectrum, from the Buddhist attempts to extinguish their personalities to the Vaishnavas' attempts to perfect their personalities, such that they gain entrance to high ontological levels. As Hirayana notes in Outlines of Indian Philosophy, every philosophical system in India has its own psychology, and it is in choosing to ignore the philosophical context of specific meditative traditions that clinical psychologists are forced to ignore that such systems come embedded with their own psychological perspectives, conditions, and goals. From this perspective, one is led to ask the question as to what extent, and in what manner, if at all, the mind undergoes a progressive transformation in an attempt to conform and adapt itself to such teleological concerns during the course of meditative practice. To entirely disregard the theoretical context is to fail to understand that meditative practices are attempts, often strenuous lifelong attempts, to condition and transform the mind such that it conforms to a variety of certain sets of soteriological, eschatological, and moral goals. Whilst there may be some actual beliefs in the assumed benefits of particular spiritual practices that serve as the initial impetus of some psychological studies, and I think an awful lot of them, probably the majority of psychologists, do have an interest in some particular meditative tradition which initiates their research. The virtual philosophical and theological void such research is conducted in ensures that theoretical considerations that could possibly provide some insight into the most beneficial manner by which to correspond and implement such practices remains alien to almost all such research. In order to initially comprehend the larger theoretical approach psychology has displayed towards Eastern religion, I also wish to consider the wider philosophical context which grounds such theory, particularly the field of philosophy of mind, as well as the spectrum of reductionist interpretations of meditational phenomena that have been proffered within psychology, especially those that emphasize the ultimately negative results of specific practices. And this is a quote from somebody called James Malan, who wrote an article in, I think it's 53, which was called "The Possible Origin of Religion as a Conditioned Reflex." And his idea was that religion developed as a shuddering reflex when we came out of the slime and began to sort of walking around on four legs or two legs. And when we saw the sun, we had a shuddering reflex, and this is the origin of religion. This is a quote from short quote from him. Mysticism too, perhaps, just needs that one sure probe into its entrails to slay forever the mystic's spiritual divinity, and to lay bare a new maze of shuddering reflexes. The claim that choosing to ignore the theoretical implications of Eastern meditative practices renders clinical research unduly limited in its potential for practical and rewarding implementation at the therapeutic level will lead into the claim that a more inclusive, thoroughgoing, and holistic approach that sufficiently comprehends the underlying theoretical currents from which specific meditational types are plucked for analysis would reveal a wealth of practical information for the psychologist concerned. Such information will, I hope, enable them to better understand the particular techniques they have chosen to research, provide a deeper degree of clarity in regards to their analysis of previous clinical trials, and to ultimately facilitate a more accurate and beneficial application of meditational processes to specific psychological conditions. Although interactions between Eastern religions and psychology go all the way back to the emergence of the idea of the unconscious within the post-romantic period of the 19th century and the writings of C.J. Cherus and Edward von Hartmann, which were directly influenced by Vedantic Hinduism, the general influence on academic psychology by Eastern traditions has been minimal. I mean, aside, of course, from James and Jung. However, there has been a growing impact in a number of different areas. Aside from the influence felt within psychotherapy by a few individuals and schools outside of the orthodox Freudian camp, with the demise of the behaviorist methodology, there has been an increasing interest in attempting to address the increasing quantity of questions concerning subjectivity and consciousness by recourse to Eastern philosophical contexts. In fact, the increase in interest in the cognitive aspect of mental life coming after the lacuna in such studies caused by behaviorism and extended my neuroscientific studies, is finding an increasing number of psychologists exploring Eastern ideas and techniques. The commitment of Eastern religion to systematic introspection is something held to hold promise in guiding psychologists in their exploration of consciousness, which the Tibetan scholar Robert Thurman suggests is akin to the West having adopted external sciences and the East having inner sciences specifically concerning consciousness, which is kind of the other extreme of the reductionist. Those psychologists who are turning eastwards for inspiration do so in the hope that they might find the system of understanding that is both more contextualized, in the sense of being able to locate the self comfortably within a broader social framework, and more holistic, in the sense of offering complete theories as to how external behavior, the brain and consciousness, are integrated in a manner that doesn't just trail off into different streams of reductions that have no overt relationship with each other. A renewed hope of objectivity is therefore presented in the form of an epistemological balance between behavior and internal awareness, which has been related in the last two decades to a renewed interest in phenomenological approaches. Although these therapeutic traditions stemming from Freud's vision are ostensibly concerned with the inner world of consciousness and self-awareness, they have still drawn generally reductionist conclusions when faced with claims about religious experience, coupled with the fact that emphasizing the role of the ego has led to reinforcement of the view that we are all in competition with each other in a hostile social world, a position normally hard to rectify with most Eastern philosophers. It is, in fact, in Jung, despite his pioneering enthusiasm for philosophical Taoism, Mahayana Buddhism, and various aspects of Hinduism, that we find a voice of caution as to the non-reflective assimilation of techniques from such traditions for mental health goals. In Psychology in the East, he warns explicitly against the appropriation of Eastern form of praxis, considering that the development of such techniques occurred in such an alien environment, such that the West's understanding of spiritual transformation, quote, has been along entirely different lines from that of the East, and has therefore produced conditions which are the most unfavorable soil one can think of for the application of yoga. In fact, Jung sees the West's increasing desire to assimilate and appropriate such religious techniques as a further manifestation of the West's desire to control and manipulate, and believed that it was more appropriate that Westerners develop their own forms of yoga. And as we shall see, he himself attempted to do this within the psychotherapeutic process. As such, Jung represents an early and fascinating attempt to engage in a hermeneutical dialogue with Eastern religions which will be explored in greater depth. Eric Fromm was also an interesting proponent of encounters between psychology and Eastern religions, particularly in his insistence that the goals of a tradition such as Zen and those of psychology were identical, namely, in that at the core of each lay a desire for self-transformation, such that the techniques of that tradition were perceived as being fully available for use by psychotherapists. He has a particular interest in that he advocated the idea in psychoanalysis and Zen Buddhism that experiential knowledge received through spiritual practice is a necessary balance to the intellectually inclined knowledge seeking that transpires in the West, where the subject observes itself as an object in order to be rigorously rationalistic. Humanistic psychology also drew from Eastern religious sources, specifically in concepts of being in the present moment and valuing spontaneity that was developed by the Gestalt school. And in hoping to expand beyond the mind-body dualism that fueled the rise of behaviorism. What deserves a higher degree of attention are certain elements of the offshoot of the humanistic school that calls itself transpersonal psychology, specifically those psychologists who are fascinated by the relationship between higher states of consciousness and ordinary mental activity, stemming from William James and Jung's conviction that mystical experience was integral to normal psychic development, which is interesting because you also find this in a lot of, well, in some Christian theologians, like Rana said, it's quite surprising, the same thing, that that whether mystical experiences were part of the normal sort of evolution of the human being, or whether they were sort of bizarre one-off things, was actually a question best left for the psychologist, which is strange if you know Rana's work. The growing interest in consciousness studies within psychology comes after a long gap since James and the Wurzburg school at the turn of the century and the rise of cognitive psychology in the 50s and 60s, which was connected to the increasing influence of phenomenology within the humanities. And there are people such as Robert Ornstein who proposed there was a bi-hemispherical theory of consciousness, suggesting that there are two primary modes of human consciousness, the left and the right hemisphere, and meditation is the right hemisphere. Anyway, in large part, much of what I wish to consider lies across the spectrum of objectively oriented psychology, from correlation to behavioral theories, that explicitly or implicitly seek to disavow the relevance of subjective states of consciousness. And it's interesting that, I mean, in psychology in general, there's been a big, obviously a big reaction to behaviorism. The idea of behaviorism said basically that the mind is what the body does. So you can understand the mind by looking at the person's body. And after some decades, people thought, well, maybe that's not the best philosophy of mind that we can really come up with. But I've not seen this, but it's my own sort of opinion that if you look at neuroscience is like a kind of internal form of behaviorism. It's like looking at what the brain does. You're not looking at what, you know, the body's doing. You're looking at the internal components of the brain. And really, it's generally very surprising because, for instance, one of the main arguments they had, at least in the beginning, when they started doing a lot of the more scientific sort of experimentation on meditation, was, well, look, you know, I mean, there's the whole thing about the God center in the brain and everything leading up to that. They were saying, well, look, you know, we know that these experiences are simply chemical electromagnetic impulses in the brain, because look, when we when we tweak this part of the brain, then, you know, this happens. And which is such a strange argument if you consider it. I think it's directly analogous to saying that, look, we know that the football game is inside the television because if you tweak this dial, look, it's gone. And it's funny that for such a long time they were applying this argument. You know, it is, anyway, I think this is also
today.
Yeah, right. But this kind of, I think that initial fascination or the continued fascination of neuroscientific attempts to understand what meditation is really, it's very interesting, it's very descriptive, but ultimately it's not really telling anybody anything that, you know, is terribly useful, which is a large statement, but I mean in general. Certainly there are areas within psychology that appear to provide a potentially useful approach to understanding religious experience, which I hope to build upon, especially the taxonomy that has arisen in object relational psychology, where mystical states are divided into two types, self-mysticism and union mysticism, which is somewhat similar to Christianity, where there is considerable scope for the application of the Eastern form of praxis and theory onto such categories. One of the central questions I assess in what I'm doing is whether meditation and yoga are, as claimed extensively by many, many psychologists, simply techniques that can be adapted for any purpose whatsoever, with the implication that any technique can be applied to any problem, and whether there are reasonable grounds for a limitation of such a claim. And that may sound a little strong, but there are books. There's, like, I was just reading one, it's called The Riding the Ox Home, and I forgot the man's name. And it's basically talking about meditation, but his central thesis throughout that entire book, and he repeats it again and again and again, is meditation is basically anything, and you can use meditation. Sitting silently with your eyes open is meditation. I mean, there's a very broad definition, but his conclusion is that meditation can be used for anything, and he never qualifies that statement all the way through. And this is just very common. He doesn't qualify it once. He doesn't say it'll make you, you know, a better mass murderer or anything like that. Goes on. One crucial issue that really needs to be investigated is the fact that whilst virtually all of the psychological trials were conducted involving advanced practitioners, of yoga and meditation, most of the psychological tests have concerned introducing an often stylized form of meditation to complete beginners, which has led to many diverse conclusions based on beginners' interactions with meditations, as well as leaving a lacuna concerning other than empiric results from assessments of advanced practitioners. Fritz Stahl notes that such empirical methods tell us how meditation affects the body, not how it affects the mind. A balanced study of mental states can only result from taking into account not only behavioral and psychological, but also experiential or subjective data. Overall, there are several major questions that this historical survey intends to highlight. Notably, how the teleologies of the Eastern traditions attempt to affect personal growth, whether psychological growth and spiritual growth are at all compatible, whether spiritual practices can be utilized for any purpose whatsoever, and specifically whether the Western emphasis on the role and development of the ego is compatible with theoretical and practical systems that attempt to lead to the dissolution of the self. I believe there is equal merit both in Nietzsche's view of the philosopher's position and in concepts found in the East, such as the Buddhist idea of upaya, skillful teaching, the most immediate cessation of suffering. And I hope that the aims of this research are ultimately compatible with such practical perspectives. In attempting to demonstrate that it is desirable to give thorough theoretical consideration as to what type of meditational system is the most appropriate for application to specific psychological conditions, in order for clinical researchers to most accurately assess which psychological conditions may be benefited from specific meditative practices, I also hope that this provides some broader degree of understanding that may be incorporated into psychologists' growing awareness of the need for a more thoroughgoing analysis of the subjective content. As I mentioned, that is a big sort of motivation for people. Psychologists at the moment is that there is this sort of lacuna of understanding the cognitive element of the mind. So what I've done actually in general, and I'll only read little bits of it, is look at early Greek philosophy and early Christianity as well, and in an attempt to understand what they understood to be meditation. And in the early Greek sense of the word, especially looking at the work of Pierre Hadot, who's a French historian of ancient thought, he wrote a very interesting book called Philosophy as a Way of Life. And in that, he makes the claim that he said he was inspired to write that book because so many modern philosophers look back at the ancient Greek philosophers and they see it as a system of thought, and then they say, well, you know, there are so many inconsistencies and there are so many problems and it's not a proper system, and they sort of, you know, punch so many holes in it. But his point was that this ancient philosophy was not meant to be a sort of systematic exposition of, you know, discrete packets of information given from one person to another. Hence his book is called Philosophy as a Way of Life. And he's pointing out that, you've all, I'm sure, read Plato's description of Socrates, and Socrates is not obviously a sort of systematic philosopher. Socrates is concerned with, and Hadot says that probably the main form of meditation, or how he defines meditation, is this dialogical interaction between not just yourself and the other people, but also internal dialogue. similar in many ways to sort of Buddhist meditation, the very beginning of Buddhist meditation, like one observes one's thoughts and comes to a sense of not actually stopping the thoughts, as in Buddhist meditation, then one comes to a certain degree of harmony. And it's very interesting work. The problem with his work actually is he doesn't really list what he considers to be the sort of spiritual praxis, his actual meditations, as he calls them. He says that the different sort of schools of ancient Greek thought, the Epicureans and the Stoics, they had different goals. Some of them were much more focused on the idea of sort of like merging with the absolute, which some forms of Neoplatonism, not merging with the absolute in the sense, but actually merging some sort of union with the absolute. And then on the other side, there are people who, especially the Epicureans and all the Stoics, they were actually very interested in developing relationships and having communities which were sort of harmonious, and that was very much the whole goal of these sort of what he considers to be meditative techniques in the ancient Greek world. I'll just read the conclusion of that. Whilst this section is intended as a brief historical survey of the origins of meditation in the Western world, and as such definitive conclusions cannot be drawn from the limited material drawn upon, there are a few basic patterns that warrant notice. Firstly, it appears that from the general evidence that spiritual exercises were believed by various traditions within the ancient world to focus on some sort of other personal transformation. And I think that's probably the main unifying element in all forms of meditation. It's about personal transformation. And that's also what I was trying to highlight, is that that element of personal transformation, whilst the psychologists have been very interested in looking at how the personality changes, and that's been my main sort of interest. And there has not been an understanding that there's a really communal element to that transformation, and often that transformation is understood to occur within a community, and especially, say, in early Christianity or something like that. It's interesting that in early Christianity the emphasis really was on communal life, and spiritual life was seen to be something that was very communal, and all of the sort of activities, the ritualistic activities of early Christianity, such as, you know, speaking in tongues, which was actually quite a thing, and the taking of ritual meals together, and all these sort of things, they all occurred within the individual establishment of Christians. There was a house, and these people were all generally held together in a spirit of love, and that was their goal, actually, was basically loving each other and loving God. And there's quite a big gap in the Middle Ages, just to speak very generally and quickly. But then, surprisingly, if one looks at the course of Protestant and Catholic theology over the last 100 years or 150 years, there's been a general mistrust of mysticism, especially in the Protestant tradition. There's some very interesting theologians who say, well, this mysticism is like the Greek disease. It's coming from... It's not a really... It's kind of solipsistic, and it's not really very helpful, because it's actually getting away. That emphasis that occurred after the Enlightenment, and that sort of increased individualization or emphasis on individualism that has occurred, has been mirrored in theology and in religious practice in many ways, that we have this fascination with private inner visions, with private inner experience. And if you look at academia's approach to mysticism in general, it's to look at the sort of like superstars of mysticism. And we look at their private inner experiences. And whereas in early Christianity and in a lot of the last 150 years within academia, there's been a real emphasis much more on the idea that this is really the opposite of what's supposed to happen. What's supposed to happen is we're supposed to experience love. And how do we experience love? By loving other people. And so, I'm not really going to have time to put this all succinctly into a sort of more coherent argument, but that's the sort of qualia that's qualia in philosophy of mind. The main problem is experience, qualia. Like, how do we actually understand anyway, in philosophy of mind, that's the central problem, is qualia. Like, to see five as a firing, we're experiencing pain. We can reduce it all very easily, but what we can't reduce is the sensation, the actual experience of having pain. That's not reducible. So similarly, this is a sort of problem with neuroscientific approaches to meditation, is that we can then tell in great, you know, electromagnetic and chemical detail, we can tell exactly what's happening, in minute detail, but we can't actually relate those experiences to, you know, how humans function, develop, and grow. It's a typical sort of reductionist technique that you said, well, this is the ocean, but actually, no, it's not the ocean. You're wrong. It's H2O. But what do we really learn from that? Not a lot. So these types of reduction of meditation, although they're not necessarily done in a sort of with a stringent empirical agenda that we are going to reduce everything and be reductionists and show that there's nothing really there, often this is the end result in many cases. So anyway. To go on and on and on, but I won't. So, yes. In conclusion, I would just say that. I hope that's all made a little bit of sense. Are there any questions?
Thank you, Chris. That's very interesting. Let's open the floor to discussion and questions.
Several questions. I'll just start with one and see if it opens up other things. You mentioned just in passing that, you know, you sort of make a quick overview of the Western traditions of meditation, that in the Middle Ages there was a gap. I would have thought there was a lot going on in the Middle Ages.
a gap
in terms of meditative theories and practices.
Yeah, I didn't mean there was a gap in meditation as per se. I mean more that by the 3rd century mysticism, as it were, became institutionalized into monasteries. So no, I didn't. I wasn't saying that. It was, I'm sorry. I probably said something.
And whatever was happening in the monastery, wouldn't have been of interest to you?
That it became. It is of interest, and I'm sorry that I don't have more time to go into it. And I really am curious to know what sort of meditative techniques they were using. I mean, Pierre Hadot says that the ancient spiritual exercises used by, everybody, the Platonists and Neoplatonists, everybody actually went into Christianity, and were used by them. But it's more the idea that. Just from reading Christian theologians studying the early period of Christianity, they say that around the 3rd or 4th century, this community of believers who were very much concerned with, according to them, loving each other basically, and being able to enter into loving relationships, that kind of, I don't know if it stopped and gradually wound down, but at the same time in the 3rd or 4th century, then there was the institutionalization of these experiences. And actually a lot of the early fathers like Origen and other people, they speak directly against talking about these inner internal experiences that one's having. They actually say that no, this isn't what we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be coming to an understanding of God's love for us and loving the other as oneself, and that this is very important. So it's curious, and it's curious to me that in the last 150 years or so, that's been brought up. I can't really say if it's happened within Christianity itself, but according to the academic study of it, then there are many, many, many Christian, Protestant, and Catholic theologians who say that mysticism is a distraction, and there's a lot of very kind of heavy rhetoric against.
And you see that shift happening, or at least from the sources you read, that shift happened around the period.
Yeah, I'm not so sure what happened to the people who were sort of still living in the communities and outside the monasteries, but it seems to that that monastic element took prevalence. There are people like Edward Schillebix, and he wrote a book called Church of the Human Face, and he says the same thing, that there were communities of believers, and that there were no hierarchies, and everything was very much... It was all based on... There are many quotes, it was based on the idea of the personal relationships of... that's the realized eschatology of Christianity. That's, the kingdom of God is here now in our loving behavior. And I didn't sort of go into it, but that's also extraordinarily similar to Vaishnavism. Mm. And when I was just interviewing Vaishnavas in Vrindavan in India about their japa practice, and most of them, I only interviewed about 50 of them, but most of them have been practicing for about 25 years, and they, a lot of them said the same thing. They said, we can't differentiate our method of practice from our everyday sadhana. And doing japa is not sort of like that, the one element in our daily lives that is making us progress spiritually. It's just one element, and it's more important in many ways. They were saying to me that we actually learn to love each other and conduct ourselves in a loving manner. So I guess my point in this in general is just that sort of social dimension and that loving sort of dimension in many ways has been lost. I know also Richard Gombrich has written some tracks on saying that love was extraordinary, well, not extraordinary, love was a very important aspect of early Buddhism, which has almost been largely lost.
So it seems like you're saying that you need to sort of recast the definition of mysticism and get away from this model of the isolated person living out in the desert.
Yeah, I'm very
surprised. The ideal mystic is...
Yeah.
Not necessarily a comprehensive definition of what mysticism is.
And the more I read, the more I'm actually very surprised that most people across the course of history have not had that approach to... Bernard McGinn wrote a very large 4-volume work on mysticism, and he says again and again that this this private approach to mysticism is he says it's basically alien to Christianity, which is surprising to me, having sort of studied theology for a while, but yeah, I agree.
It's fairly alien to Christian mysticism, I would say. I mean, when you actually read the medieval Christian mystics, That's not what they're talking about.
Really?
They talk an enormous amount about love and community.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, the opposite view would be that what happened around the 3rd century is that because Christianity has gone out into to take control of society, the continuation of the early church is precisely in the monastic.
Right.
This is what you might hear more from Catholic thinkers, of course. So that would see it as a natural continuation.
In what sense?
Well, there you get a community which is, its main focus is on Christian practice, as the early church was.
Okay.
Whereas, of course, what in practice is happening is that leaders become politically involved, they become engaged in all sorts of things which the early church would never have occurred to the early church, or were not possible to the early church. Inevitably.
Whereas in the monastic circles, what the more Christian, like in the Origins type of practice,
I think you
had
the kind of community intensity continuing.
Right.
However, among the Egyptian fathers,
there is a kind of a decoupling from the wider society.
But the early church was decoupled from the
society. Right. Yes, because
it
was
the wider society was engaged in attacking the fundamentals of it. Rather strongly, as I recall.
It's true. If I think of Thomas the Kempis and in the Imitation of Christ, I mean, it seems like that it's so strongly speaking about loving others and living in the community.
And arising directly from Augustinian Christianity, and very much from the mystical tradition, like Reisbrook and others.
I guess what sort of clouded my vision in many ways is just that academics in the last 100 years have been very fascinated by the idea of individual mystical experience, and so perhaps I'm looking at it through that kind of lens, or had been before until
this. But this is surely the outcome of this post-Enlightenment privatization. And everything up until then, like I was saying, the communal dimension of the Desert Fathers going through into monasticism, they saw themselves very much trying to embody the spirit of the early church, as recorded in the Acts, where everyone is living commonly, sharing everything in common, no one has any property, that sort of thing. That was their kind of proof text. And it's really only the sort of secular privatization of religion that has constructed the notion of religious experience. And also, interestingly, done the same with Buddhism. So that you get the idea that Buddhism is all about having meditation experiences, but that is largely a post-Enlightenment or even Protestant construction of Buddhist meditation from the 19th century onward. Whereas if you sort of look again at early Buddhism, it's very much a social activity. Sangha is a social body.
Right.
It's not about sitting in a corner and going on chanting and having this sort of private experiences.
But then again, something like Chan Buddhism is much more focused on the individual meditative practice.
No. I think in all of these cases, the problem is what people idealize and what they do aren't the same thing. The typical practice of your Chan monk or your Thai monk today is in a large or small community. It's very much a communal activity. And I think it's partly why they admire the solitary monks. But even so, those solitary teachers, what do? They come back and start monasteries.
I was going to say there's also a thing about phases that you can have, in a dedicated, both in the more occasional, but especially so in the professional mystic, if you want to call it that. That, very often you see this pattern of a period at some point in time where the self propels, or maybe his teacher tells him or her to go. And they have this period, and then they come back.
Right.
That, it's part of a sort of a procedural, different needs at different times.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious to ask that, if I might ask. I haven't really read about this very much, but it seems to me that if you look at a community of, say, Christians or Vaishnavas, then the emphasis is on loving the other person. Whereas my guess would be, having talked to Buddhist monks and seeing them and reading the literature, that it's almost like the Sangha is sort of the most convenient way to practice one's individual Sangha. And the emphasis on the other person is really not anywhere near as intense or anywhere near as important as the sort of more theistic. Is that totally wrong? Or?
easily find examples of people I know, monks who practice rather that sort of way.
Mm.
And you certainly get much more of that with Western monks, but they may be coming from a different ideology, which is very germane to what you're saying, of course.
Mm.
But, I mean, what are your typical Thai monks doing? I mean, they are spending an amount, or your typical Siamese monks, you know. I mean, all those people who were out in the tsunami, I mean, what actually happened? The people who survived the tsunami, they were taken off into the local Buddhist monasteries and looked after. It was automatic that that's what the monks would do in that situation.
Sure, I mean, there's a community sort of element. But in terms of one's, in terms of the soteriological sort of practice, I mean, is the other person, from what I know of Buddhism, the other person is almost inconsequential to one's individual practice.
Practice for yourself, practice for others, practice for both, practice for neither, as they formed it.
Really?
The last is not recommended.
Well,
but I mean, why all, would you have all the emphasis on compassion? Why all the emphasis on love and kindness and so on? Yes?
One thing that you might have seen, you know, because I'm also looking and trying to understand and make the apologies which I like doing. It's just a kind of personal taste. Is the way I've been formulating it in my mind, and it's still very much happening, so it's very fuzzy, is that you could have some sort of basic almost direction of the senses as a different types of practice. One is towards another outside, which is very clearly defined, a god or an entity or community and so on. The other one is more towards the inside.
Mm.
However, we find very consistently that the primary, you know, and the one towards inside might trick you into thinking it's a kind of egoistical enterprise.
Mm.
However, if you look at what they say, the going inside is always to somehow dissolve the personality.
Right.
And the only choice you have, if you do go along that way, is to become altruistic. There's nothing.
Sorry, is to become?
Altruistic.
Uh-huh.
There's nothing, you know.
Yeah, sure. If you dissolve yourself, you'd be more altruistic.
But we're switching to a different sense of other. And it's very relevant, of course, because from a theistic point of view, that's other. From my point of view as a non-theist, that's an even more abstract internal mental creation that people are practicing love towards. So it's actually further away from loving other people. Now I'm just
sorry, which one is further away?
When you focus on a deity in that way.
Right.
Because that's actually, from my point of view, internal.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm not actually arguing that's a better viewpoint than the other.
I'm just expressing
pointing
the difference.
Out that you know, you're using categories in certain kinds of ways.
Sure.
That's all.
And
but it shouldn't confuse the two others.
Right. Just to follow on from that, there is a point of view that this whole notion of Buddhist monastic practice is all about meditation is of relatively recent provenance and itself inseparable from personal enlightenment, Western influence, and Buddhists responding to that. So a lot of things like Vipassana retreats and all this sort of thing, which is almost your paradigm of Buddhist practice, is a very recent invention and doesn't really have as much grounding in the tradition as we might think. And there's actually your average Buddhist monk in your average Buddhist monastery probably that's not what it's all about. It's just about living in a community, forming a community. And there's a very interesting article by Robert Scharf, title of which I forget. He's mainly looking at Far Eastern Buddhism, which he really unpacks this kind of this sort of recent history.
What was his name?
Robert Scharf, S-H-A-R-F.
And the problem lies here with the word meditation, and this is actually came up earlier, of course. But there isn't, I mean, I like to argue sometimes, there is no word for meditation in Pali or Sanskrit,
which is a good point,
There are all sorts of words in Pali and Sanskrit which refer to specific things which in some way relate to meditation, but there's nothing that's exactly equivalent. I mean, you might want to make a suggestion of one, but
right. jhana, dhyana or something, but that's more like absorption. It doesn't...
It's very specific.
Very specific.
Well,
yeah.
I have, you know, meditation. Because in the past, I don't even do it.
No, I think if you look semantically, the English term meditation in this sense would connect with what you were saying about the modernization of, you know, the modern reception of
the word meditation.
When I talk about meditation, and I think when most Buddhist monks talk about meditation who come from the Asian background, I think most of the time they're translating bhavana. But bhavana isn't just, it's just as much avoiding cruel speech. That's an act of bhavana, just as much as avoiding angry thoughts, which you might call meditation.
So what you were saying about the
doesn't have that kind of narrowness.
Not being able to draw that line very well. I think would apply also to Buddhist meditation.
Yeah, I'm happy
not
to hear
modern
it.
Though. Yeah.
Most of what the only extensively I've only read in Buddhism is in Chan Buddhism, and so that emphasis is always, even back to the very 11th, 12th century, that emphasis on appears to be there on sort of the individual meditation and doing it even 10 hours a day traditionally. And also, I was just also interviewing a few Tibetan monks in India, and they all do like 4 or 5 hours a day, they told me. So, which traditions wouldn't meditate?
Well, this is...
They told me they would take 4 hours a day.
Yeah, right.
I think this modern thing might also have brought a kind of, you know, revival.
Well, yes, exactly. That's what
for
I'm
good
saying.
And
it's
for
as
bad,
much,
you know.
It's as much a Western construct in the Asian context.
Yeah, which they've responded to.
Yes, and they've sort of created,
yeah.
But it is quite a recent... Of course, there is a tradition. I mean, there are Buddhist sutras of meditation teaching from the Buddha to observe the breath philosophy. So it's not, you know, it's not that there's no smoke without fire, but it's just this image we have that Buddhist monastic practice is all about meditation. It needs kind of revisiting.
It's the narrow definition as well. See, I mean, the anthropologists always say this about timings, but not merely in medicine. I actually take the opposite view on this, but I think we do. I mean, to start with, they nearly all do 2 hours of chanting, which I consider
and
it's certainly
rituals,
bhavana.
You know, the rituals.
No, it's certainly a part of meditation. I think many of them have gone through a period of more intensive meditation when they're younger, and may feel when they're rather busy and older that they're not really seriously doing meditation anymore. They may be only doing it an hour a day, and you can't regard that as meditation. So they may well answer an anthropologist who asks them, do you meditate? But the answer is don't. Not by their standards, they don't. So you've got to be very, very careful, because my experience, and it's going from the inside rather than the outside, is that it's very widespread, and many of them do. And I suspect you get the answer you look for. I take that as a claim to me as well. But you know, I'd be very, very wary of the evidence on this. What I am absolutely sure of is that Taiwan has a widespread practice of meditation, whatever the percentage among monks is. And many monks who have practiced it a great deal. But in this wider sense of meditation, you know, you can't separate it off in that kind of way. You wouldn't get the kind of numbers of famous meditation teachers that you get in Thailand if there weren't a lot of people who are not so good at it as well, who don't take it so far on in the sense. So I wouldn't go that far. But Sri Lanka maybe, which is where the Qigong group is coming from, of course. And yes, there are meditation monks in Sri Lanka, but it certainly isn't anything like a comment. So maybe we should look in different countries, different places.
And also not to stereotype meditation just in the sitting, you know, closely. But you say the Tibetan rituals that are done twice, three times a day, every day. Is that meditation? Is that not meditation?
Yeah. And maybe that might affect the Tibetan calculation too. If they count their sadhanas as meditation and the Thais don't count their chanting as meditation, you'll get a different answer, won't you?
But this again is about the construction of meditation as this kind of private activity. Whereas what you're pointing up is that it's very much about the communal practice.
The private is a necessary part of it.
Yes, but it's just that we've sort of got this typical idea that that's what it's all about.
I wanted to bring another topic instead of
supposed to stop at 3, so...
Oh,
oh, does it? Oh, we'll carry on then.
So you're making a basic criticism of the studies on meditation and psychology.
Yeah,
so what's your... Are you going to chalk out an alternative? I mean, you've called into question the whole notion of what meditation is. You've called into question whether they're involving the teleologies of these so-called meditations. Are you going to chalk out an ideal experiment?
No. It's more how they approach the experiments. I mean, if there's any practical element, it's just sort of hoping that... Well, I think it is a very sort of colonial orientalist approach that we just look at the religious tradition. And as Jung, I was reading, Jung was warning, can you really just appropriate it? Can you really just take that meditative tradition and use it for any goal whatsoever? Can you be a better, you know, a better mass murderer? If the teachers are there. So, in many cases, it just intrigues me that people, psychologists, have no interest to understand just this one point, which is that the would practitioners for so many thousands of years have really actually performed these meditations and, you know, on a daily strenuous often basis if they didn't see their personalities change. And if that's the case, if we assume that, and I think the fact that psychologists decide to do clinical trials kind of presupposes that they do have some belief or that people's personalities are changing, and that's what, you know, so far the empirical evidence suggests, although I don't know, this is only being done with beginners. Then why do the psychologists ignore an understanding of how the personality changes during the decades long practice of specific meditative traditions? So in one sense that's very hard. I mean, for instance, in the Vaishnava tradition, they're kind of very elaborate expositions of how the personality changes. Like in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, for instance, it describes all of the different types of emotional states that one can be elevated into, and such things. And similarly in Buddhism, although I'm not so sure about how we have to sort of get into that. So it seems curious that psychologists have just done this sort of appropriation of meditation and then just say, well, we're just going to utilize it to try and control stress and depression. And it's a worthy sort of, you know, aim in and of itself. But I do believe that there would be certain types of meditation are producing certain psychological effects. And if the psychologists had a better understanding of that, then they could utilize pragmatically different types of meditation for different types of mental sort of conditions. And so far, that just hasn't been done at all.
Sorry for those of you who are already at my thing, but do you know the work of the Mind and Life Institute? Because they are doing exactly that.
Oh, no,
and they've been doing, I mean, now they're doing more neuroscience, but they've been at it for about 15 years.
And this is the...
It's more Buddhist, it's almost exclusively Buddhist,
oh,
I would say.
It's
still, it's very, you know, about...
Yeah.
And they are doing, you know, it's practitioners, neuroscientists, and other type of sciences, historians of science, and academics in the humanities, some of which are practitioners, some of which are not, you know, a whole mixture.
They've had a lot of independent sort of studies come out of that.
They've had both, you know, completely scientific studies and other types of discussions from which books have come, more like, you know, discussions as comparing the different attitudes and methodologies across, you know, the sort of divide East and West. So do look at it, Mind and Life Institute, and... Because that could, unfortunately, there's nothing I think comparable in either Christian or Hindu things.
And they actually look at the way different forms of meditation transform people's personalities?
They look very specifically at types of meditation with adults, mainly. You know, you were saying it's only been tried on beginners, and I know some studies have been like that, but these studies are, you know, have been done also.
And they're not physiological.
Maybe also comparative, you know, some more adult practitioners. I don't remember, but they've been doing lots and very serious.
And they're not physiological?
They are also physiological, yes. For example, one that springs to mind, but, you know, I don't remember scientific lingo about it and so on, was about, it is recognized by, I think, cognitive science, which ones are the centers that are connected with compassion. And they demonstrated that these very other practitioners could develop a lot more of it under certain circumstances that people don't practice consistently. So, you know, that's where I don't know if all that is, you know, already completely valid and useful. Lots of applications for therapeutic things, quite specific. So, you know, it's not perfect and it's early days and these sort of things take a lot of time, but they're doing very serious work.
Chris, you don't like reductionist accounts of meditation.
Do
you think that reductionist accounts have anything to add? Like Holderlin talks about the river, the poet describes the river much better than the geographer does, and gives him a more accurate sense of the river. So you kind of, I'm just wondering, do you think there's any value in these psychological kind of studies?
The physiological,
neuroscientific ones, yeah.
I think it's I'm interested to sort of see the motivation originally. I mean, I sort of know, like in philosophy of mind, a little bit of the context of how these experiments are being received. And in one sense, it's, you know, what if they found nothing? What if they found that there was no electrical activity occurring during meditation? What would they have said? I mean,
it's hardly surprising that there isn't it? I mean, one would be surprised if that were the case.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So I think, I'm sure some people would have said, well, look, it's just all your imagination. But then again, imagination would have an electromagnetic footprints of some sort. So, anyway, that's a strange way to answer your question. But I mean, just reductionism in general, just the fact that, look, you know, people, just in philosophy, for instance, they'll say, no, that's not water, that's H2O. Mm. And you think, well, what's the difference? So similarly, they have learned very interesting things. You know, like the studies, the correlations between the Zen practitioners and the yoga practitioners and all the different things. So I think it's very curious. It does give you a real insight into what's happening in the brain in one sense. But this just seems to be a kind of consensus almost among psychologists that, oh, look, we know what's happening now. Whereas the fact of the qualia, you know, the personal experience of meditation, is something which is so radically removed. And this is what I know some people point out and seems very obvious to me, is that this, it's almost an extension of the behavioural sort of thing. It's like, you know, behaviourists will tell you that a religious person living in New York is more likely to have a dog or something. And you think, well, great. That's really telling me something interesting, but what does that really tell me? Is that really something? So similarly, saying that, this particular, there are these alpha waves happen at this point in time. Yeah, that's interesting, because you can correlate it with what's actually the subjective experience. So that's interesting, because it can tell you that, yeah, there's a material basis, but we know there's basically a material basis for anything. So ultimately, I don't think that much will come out of it. There has been so much fascination. I think the fascination's waning a little bit.
It's interesting that it doesn't work the other way. They had Richard Dawkins, who was a famous atheist biologist here at Oxford, and they charged. He actually went in, they did the experiment, they excited the part of the brain where they think meditation occurs and this sense of euphoria. And they shocked that part, they excited that part of the brain, and he was sat there and I don't feel anything. Did it on the BBC, I think. So, I mean, technically, it was this exact, very similar thing happening in the brain, but there was no phenomena. Psychic phenomena.
Catholicism, you know. So it's pretty absurd.
Well, maybe he's lying, or.
There is a kind of religious politics element to these areas that exist to me. If you're, to any religious tradition as applies to, if you're moving into a culturally alien context or environment, you're not going to present the whole package. Because if you do, people are unacceptable. Necessarily so. So you're bound to select a more simplified version. And that then, of course, opens you up to the criticism that this isn't really quite genuine, what you're really doing back in your own place would be unsuitable in this cultural context. And this is variations of the kind of arguments we're quoting from various theologians and from Jung and so on. But, I mean, I notice it with Christianity, and not only with Christianity. Yeah? But the kind of... they tend to put the argument one way here, and the other way round in India or Southeast Asia. And I'm not accusing anybody of insincerity, because I think every religion is doing it. I think Vaishnavas are doing it, Buddhists are doing it as well. I think it's simply what happens when religious traditions move between cultures. And we shouldn't take either end of it too seriously for that very reason.
We're tired.
Yeah.
There's a lot of sophistry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's human nature, isn't it?
Yeah.
I was wondering when you were talking, when you were talking about the, what was it, looking too much at the, you know, the physical phenomena and not enough at the motivation and so on. I think that's very significant, and it's something I also want to look at more. One of the things that I think I might be able to hook on, but I need to look at the literature there and how it's defined and discussed, is the role of the imagination. Because, you know, whatever you believe in, whatever might actually be out there or inside or not there, the way we actually use it as human beings is by building these images around it, and practices and, you know, structures of sorts which support and nourish us as human beings. And there I think it's important, and I would wish, you know, I think to some extent people like this mind and life people are doing it. When these things are studied, that will be taken into consideration very seriously, you know, and see the differences between approaches. So not just a physiosomatic, psychosomatic techniques, you know, the gross psychosomatic techniques, but these more subtle forms in the imagination. So I think that, you know, it's two different levels. Of course, they are merged, but, you know, one can analyze them just for the purposes of understanding things better.
But can I ask, what do you mean by imagination?
That's what I want to find out. That's why I've asked a colleague of mine who's just written a book on it to give me the top books on imagination, especially in the religious domain. Just because recently I've realized how incredibly important it is for human beings, how so much of our behavior goes through that.
I think
you know, one of the Buddhist things is to become aware of such things, like, you know, the Dhamma levels and self-analysis, is to start and become aware of this type of things.
To learn not to take the self so seriously. To learn not to take the self so seriously.
Yeah, because you become aware of how much it is a construction in that sense.
I think perhaps in a somewhat similar way, I'm very interested in desire. You know, how desire really is such a motivational. That's motivational. Why do we do things?
Yes.
You know, how does that relate to it? You know, how does that formulate sort of one's meditative experiences?
Indeed, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And desire, you know, whatever aim, and then the theology is, in my understanding, all about aims.
In your work, though, Chris, have you found differences between, say, Vaishnava practitioners and Buddhist meditators?
In terms of
their personalities, or
well, that's the thing that I'm curious about. I mean, so far I've kind of been doing the contextual aspect of it and more general, and so that's one of the main questions, really, which I'm yet to.
Some practices attract certain personality types.
That would be a difficult question. I would really be speculating. I'm more interested in the sort of idea of how people's personalities change, but of course that's obviously the fact that different personality types are attracted to different different styles of meditation. Would you notice a difference, for instance, between Buddhist monks and Vaishnava monks or anything like that? Would anybody say, has anyone noticed any profound personality sort of differences between them? It's almost so sort of subjective and general that people probably wouldn't really want to put forward their
detests or something.
But I think there are. I mean, without going into it, I mean, I think if you look, I don't think you could say that everybody, for instance, who adopts a monastic lifestyle has a similar personality. I think across the traditions, I mean, you do find very distinct personalities.
Mm.
And that's why I was interviewing Vaishnavas and some Tibetan monks. I'm yet to interview more Buddhists, but I was asking the Vaishnavas basically, how do you view your personalities having changed? And a lot of them were in sort of their mid late 50s, early 60s, and they started in the late 60s, and they've been doing it regularly. And it was really very fascinating. You know, how did they see their personalities having changed?
Were they all blokes, or did you ask women as well?
No women.
And your work is both into Christianity and in South Asian religions?
No, I have, in the beginning it's quite a bit on Christianity, because I'm really looking at the Western context and how Eastern forms of meditation are sort of within the psychology sort of realm. Maybe it won't end up in my thesis, but I just need to understand the sort of Christian context. And I do wish I could go more into understanding Christian meditation and all that sort of stuff, but just looking at early Christianity and sort of then Christian theologians the last 150 years, and there's a great deal of similarities, so I was very surprised. But like you say, I mean, it's also, they tend to say that there was this lacuna in the Middle Ages, but that's perhaps really not there at all.
More than some Catholic politics.
But no one's found any differences. I mean, could I ask you, I mean, between Buddhists and Christians, I mean, do you not see that their personalities change during the course of their practice?
I think, to me, it seems that the difference among Buddhist monks, and even between traditions within Buddhism, are as great as the differences between traditions.
Mm.
But there are, that would be my thing. We're Westerners, you say, we do seem to get a kind of typecasting, that they are attracted to some particular Eastern tradition. And I do get some suspicion, I can think of Vipassana, Westerners are attracted to do the Vipassana meditation, that there's a tendency for a lot of them to build a certain kind of psychological type. But I don't think, from what I have seen, that is true of the Vipassana meditators in Burma or Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you would expect. Because they're not really going from a kind of rather vague idea and know how it's presented.
Mm.
And you've got a wider cross section of society there.
Well, the psychologists have found, I mean, across many studies, for instance, that, you know, people who start meditation tend to be, you know, more educated and more balanced, less likely. Although also there have been some studies which have found that people who are inclined to meditation are more disturbed and more confused. And in one sense, that makes sense. I mean, you can look at them in isolation and say, well, it's conflictual. But actually, in many cases, we know that people do choose to do meditation because they see it as some sort of therapeutic device, and therefore you will be attracting people who are perhaps have some degree of instability. But don't you think that perhaps that if you really have a goal of dissolution of the personality, and then you have another goal.
You've got a goal of dissolution of personality.
What is it?
You haven't got one to start with.
Right,
but
you know what I mean. Dissolution of the non-existent personality.
No, it's about whether you view things as rigid entities or whether you view everything as process.
Right, but
that's
bring that, blowing out the flame, bringing that process to an end. Doesn't that
it's
aim...
It's different from what you said. It's very important to say.
But don't you think that blowing out of the flame, then, or say, compared
there's
to...
There's a text somewhere that says that. But you have to ask your question, what did they mean by it? What did they think was the nature of fire before it was lit and after it was blown out?
Cessation of personal existence.
And that's, well, that they may have thought the fire was lighted.
Mm.
That was the more general Indic view.
Mm.
You mustn't assume modern physics in the interpretation of ancient Sumerian fire. Which is what people are doing there, I think. No?
Well, the fire was latent, did you say?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So when they say, where did the fire go when it blew out?
Yeah,
and we can't speak about it.
Mm-hmm.
At all. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we have to stop now.
It's just very transcendent.
Transcendent.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Chris. A very, very interesting paper and a stimulated and very good discussion. Thank you.
Very good topic discussion.
Yeah, big topic. Well, thanks everyone for coming, and that's the last graduate seminar for this term.
Nobody else in the Faculty of Geology was willing to do it.
No, they're not.